After our extensive discussion and demonstration, it is now time for a complete performance of Franz Joseph Haydn's Symphony No. 104 in D major, performed by the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia, conducted by our host and commentator, Rob Capello.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rob Capello conducting the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Sinfonia in Franz Joseph Haydn's Symphony No. 104 in D major, nicknamed The London. All those here in Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan acknowledging the performance and these performers. This recorded in January of this year. We'll head now back down to the stage and a Q&A with Rob and the musicians of the orchestra entertaining questions from those in the audience.
Warren Day, fantastic. Warren Day, yes. All right, here's your chance to ask them how they did it. They are just an incredibly fun group to work with. All right, who has a question of any kind? Chance of a lifetime. Yes, go ahead, sure.
I feel like we heard a lot of syncopated rhythms tonight, but maybe the 20th century syncopated rhythms were frowned upon. Was it okay?
Oh, he said he heard lots of syncopated rhythms and he wanted to know if it was okay. I would say their definite answer is yes. Yes, tons of syncopations, everywhere you go. So much of the life of this piece has to do with syncopation. Yes, it was perfectly allowed, and evidently it was very successful, yes. Anyone else? Yes, sure, go ahead.
Did Haydn designate the number of string instruments?
Good question. He wanted to know if Haydn designated the number of string instruments. No, basically you used whatever you had. You know, if you had a small group, in fact, you know, Esterházy originally, he had a very small group. You used whatever you had. If you had a small group, you used it. If you had a big group, he had about 40 players in London for this, which is actually quite similar to what we have. I think we probably have almost exactly 40, something like that. How many firsts? Pretty close. So this is pretty much the size. But you used whatever. You know, today the tradition has become to do Mozart with very small orchestras because he often had small orchestras, and people do research and make a living out of finding pay lists and, you know, discovering, oh, he only had 6 violins. But the truth is he loved huge orchestras, and every once in a while he would have like 50 strings and he would say that was the greatest. So basically you used what you had, but both of them really loved large orchestras. And this was a very big orchestra for him, bigger than Esterházy, about 40 in London. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, were the violin or strings using steel strings at this time, or using gut?
Good, he wants to know about strings and steel or gut. Somebody, one of you must want to take this one. Somebody, go ahead.
We're using regular strings. The gut string is when we're playing an accent. Nowadays, modern playing, it's so easy to break up the gut string, and it's super expensive.
What were they using back then?
Back then, definitely gut string. There's no steel strings.
Yeah, everything was gut strings back then. And you know, it's the same thing as going back and hearing forte pianos. It's very hard to get back into. If you hear a gut string orchestra now, it takes a good bit of time, sort of like watching those old black and white movies. It takes a while to sort of get back in the context because at first it sounds pale in comparison. But everything got bigger. Steel strings for here, bigger strings and sounding boards for the piano. Everything was about public concerts. And it really started with Haydn. You know, these public concerts in London were some of the first really successful concerts for a wide range of people. Before that, it was a private club. You know, you'd have private academies, and it was only for the elite. But by the time you got to these concerts in London, everybody, the hoi polloi, was allowed to go, anyone who could buy a ticket. So the whole idea of big concert halls with steel strings and big pianos, as time marches on, you have to fill those big halls with sound. But yes, they were using gut strings at the time. Anyone have a question? We have this wonderful orchestra here. Anyone for the orchestra? Go ahead, yes.
Does this group play together, or are they just...
Does this group play together? Do you mean tonight? Hopefully, the answer to that was yes. No, does the group play together on a regular basis? Who wants to take that? Anyone? Oh, here, I'll give it to him. Microphone, here we go.
So there are a lot of students at this school, and we play in a variety of ensembles, ranging from duos and trios all the way up to very, very large orchestras. Yes, we all play with each other in various ensembles very regularly, and I can speak from experience, it is a unique joy to play with these ensemble members.
And also, they will be back in March for our final program of the season, which is right on this stage with Dvorak's 8th Symphony. So we're going to somehow fit that on the stage, and a lot of these people will be back here to play that one as well. Anyway, for the orchestra, yes, go ahead.
I thought those bassoon parts were wonderful. Thank you very much.
He liked the bassoon parts. Yes, there you go. That's right. And we heard all of them. Anyone up there? Yes. Do I see a hand up there, or are you just scratching? Okay. Okay, I think you're just scratching. Yes, right here. Go ahead. One second.
How is Manhattan School of Music different from Juilliard?
And this one will be on the air. He wanted to know how the Manhattan School of Music is different than Juilliard. Who wants to take that? Oh, here we go. Can we pass the microphone over to him? Be careful, the president of the school is here.
I was just going to say, our president's in the audience. I'm not going to necessarily compare the schools, but I can tell you what's unique and very special about Manhattan School of Music. I think for me, when Mr. Coppola was talking in the Haydn Symphony about how Haydn can take something that's so simple and give it so much variety and so much change, I think that's very special. And I know that definitely in my studies at MSM, it can seem simple, you know, the school and all of those things, but there's so much nuance there and so much beauty. And that's why I'm so happy to be a student there.
That's great. Maybe one or two more. Was somebody shouting up there? Oh, okay, over here. Go ahead, yes.
I wondered if the students are required to learn more than one instrument.
Oh.
And if so, could they play another part in the symphony?
So you'd like us to replay the symphony with them switching parts? Okay. She wanted to know if they were required to learn another instrument, and could they actually do that? Let's see. Are you required to? Pass that back to him. Sure, go ahead.
I was going to say, I can play the trombone part. But no, we're not required to learn another instrument.
Do you have a keyboard requirement?
Yeah.
Keyboard requirement. So they have to play a little bit of keyboard.
Actually, I don't, but right. Many of us don't. But some of us do have to learn some piano.
Do people in the conducting program have to play more than one instrument?
Okay. Some keyboard requirement.
They have a keyboard requirement as well? Okay, good. Good question. Do you teach multiple instruments? Are you looking for work? Is that okay. All right. Good. Yes, go ahead. She said, in order to achieve such a magnificent performance, how much rehearsal time is necessary? Well, we met yesterday. So we rehearsed yesterday and then some today. So that's how much time. But as I've said many times here, you know, it's not the rehearsal time that we spend on this piece. It's the 20 years that they've all spent in their practice rooms, not having a life as teenagers, learning their instrument, and then all the years they spend together that actually makes it possible. So it's not really just the 2 days that we spent, it's the years and years that they spent by themselves, all the classes they took in the nuanced program that's offered there, all the concerts they've all played together in all their different programs that allows them to come together and do something like this so quickly. So I think it's really remarkable how well they did in only 1 day of rehearsal. So. But they've basically given up their life in order to be able to do this. Maybe one or two more and we'll call it a night. Yes, go ahead, sure.
So this is pretty extraordinary for the audience, and I'm wondering, for the orchestra, did practicing for this particular thing change how you actually performed it tonight?
Okay, she said it was remarkable for the audience, and she wanted to know whether it was changed anything for the orchestra. Was it interesting for the orchestra? Did it change the way they performed it, or was this just business as usual? Who has a microphone over there right, for her? Go ahead. No, it was revelatory. Go ahead.
So this was actually a really good experience, and I've been to many concerts like this, but I've never been able to perform in one. So it was an honor to work with him as well. Thank you so much. To play and to learn at the same time, not just watch and learn. And I definitely needed this. It was like a breath of inspiration after a while of just practicing and being stuck in a practice room. So thank you so much.
Yes. Always happy to get someone out of a practice room because it makes me feel less guilty for not being in a practice room myself. Last question, who wants to end the night? Over there. Go ahead.
Is there any way of reconciling classical music and popular music? I'm thinking of a Gershwin song, A Foggy Day in London Town.
Okay, his question was, is there any way of reconciling popular music and classical music? Now, I just want to know, when you say reconciling, in what way do you mean? Do you mean like merging the two in a single piece of music, or making the two warring camps like each other better? Or, I'm just not sure what you mean by reconciling.
I mean, when we come here, we're hearing classical music.
Right.
If we go to a Gershwin concert, we're hearing popular music.
Right.
Is there any way of reconciling?
Got you. Okay. Well, first of all, he said, you know, when we come here, you're hearing classical music, but when you go to hear, you know, a Gershwin concert, you're hearing popular music. But how many people came to the first program of the year on Gershwin? So the answer is, hopefully, we're reconciling it in this very series. How many people came to our Ellington Big Band program last year? Actually, these programs certainly attempt to do that. You know, one of Ellington's most famous quotes is, he says, there's only two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And that's really one of the basic philosophies of this series. So this series will do every kind of music. I've done Gregorian chant, I've done Javanese gamelan music, I've done Steve Reich, I've done Gershwin, I've done big band. So this series is all about what makes it great, and all kinds of music are welcome. We let everybody in. And on that note, I just want to thank our wonderful orchestra one more time. Would you take one more bow, please? Coming back in March. See you for Dvorak. Thank you. Thank you.
Rob Capello and the musicians of the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Sinfonia on this episode of What Makes It Great, focusing on the final symphony, the Symphony No. 104 in D major of Franz Joseph Haydn. For all these broadcasts we bring you of What Makes It Great from the home of What Makes It Great, Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, we want to thank, of course, Rob Capello, also Lydia Kontos, Executive Director of Kauffman Music Center, Emily Krell, Merkin Concert Hall Producer and Managing Director, and Joan Jastrzebski, Communications Director. Our recording engineer for this program was Bill Moss. You can find out what's happening at Merkin Concert Hall and the Kauffman Music Center by going to their website, Kauffman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, kauffmanmusiccenter.org. What Makes It Great is made possible in part through the sponsorship of David and Phyllis, because classical music is essential, and also Dragon Thistle Studio in Solbury, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Our next What Makes It Great, that Dvorak Symphony No. 8 Rob mentioned, will come your way Friday, May 4th. This broadcast you can hear again tomorrow afternoon at 2, and as a special repeat encore, Monday night, as my Celebrating Our Musical Future, since this features the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia, and the Manhattan School of Music is such a vital partner in that unique program presenting concerts, recitals, and music events from the great music schools in our country. If you enjoy hearing What Makes It Great, support what you hear. Even more importantly, your donation today counts towards our annual March Bach 500, where we're looking for 500 donations in any amount before Bach's birthday on March 21st. Go to our website, wwfm.org, and make that donation in membership and help us towards our goal. With the little time we have remaining, I thought we'd hear a short romance for violin and orchestra by the man who made it possible for Franz Joseph Haydn to be such a grand celebrity in England and cause Haydn to compose those last sets of London symphonies, culminating in the symphony we heard tonight, the number 104. That would be the German violinist, composer, conductor, and music impresario, Johann Peter Salomon. Midori Seiler is our violinist with Concerto Köln. I'm David Ozenberg. What Makes It Great is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.